Once again, as I mentioned just previously, I'm a little behind in recording these episodes, and so consequently, the discussions have caught up to me, so to speak. And so we have moving on to the standard at the professional now, and we nearly made it through all the professional before this recording is taking place. So instead of just going by what we talked about during that class, I'm going to talk about everything that we've talked about the professional during class, because it all falls under one topic. Okay, so we start off with several forms, and I'm going to just give a brief synopsis and then a big takeaway, if that makes sense. So Heath v. Swift Wings here, what happened is that there was an incident who was a pilot who was involved in a crash that killed him, his wife, his son, and a family friend. The witness was the wife of the family friend, and the people in this claim are estates for the daughter, estates of the family. That's getting too deep into it. The biggest takeaway from here is that the standard for a professional is an objective one within their field. This is not going to be subjective. We're not going to look at the pilot's level, his specific level in training, and compare that to other pilots' level in training within his field. So in other words, a doctor must act as a objective doctor would. A pilot needs to act as an objective pilot would. However, if somebody claims to have superior skill or a specialty or specialized in some way, they can be held to a higher standard. We also don't want to use the word average here. We don't want to say acted according as the average doctor would, or acted according to the average pilot would, because that, by definition, means that 50% of people are not going to meet the standard, which is excessive, and quite frankly, it sounds unreasonable. So instead, we're going to use a minimum standard, and it's a standard where most people in the field can actually reach. We have here Hodges versus Carter. This is quite an unfortunate case. It's a legal malpractice case. Hodges owned a drugstore, an emphasis on the word owned with an ED past tense, because it burned down, and he tried to sue the insurance companies, and the insurance companies didn't give him money, so he tried to get money from the insurance companies, they wouldn't give him money, so he sued them. And his attorneys were following a local custom. They mailed the service. The insurance companies, for the first time ever, contested that service, saying, no, you did not do it the proper way. And the court said, no, you didn't do it the proper way. By that time, the statute of limitations had run up, meaning that he couldn't sue them again properly. And so he sued his attorney, saying that they should have known that they weren't doing it properly. Well, the court here, it says that lawyers have a duty to be competent in their work, to exercise their best judgment, and use ordinary care and diligence when they are consulting with the client. An attorney is not going to be held liable for a mere error of judgment if there's a previous legal custom that had not been settled by a higher court and then is later settled. They cannot be expected to anticipate the change of that custom. I was actually on call for that case, which was quite interesting. My notes were not extensive, but I'd say it's quite memorable. You have to feel bad for the dude because... I apologize, that is unprofessional. You have to feel very sorry for Hodges because he first lost his drugstore, and then he couldn't collect from the insurance companies, and then he couldn't collect from his attorneys. So he has to start all over, and I don't know what ended up happening there, but I am curious. Anyways, that's a little side tangent. We have Boyce v. Brown here, the plaintiff, the patient. We're getting into medical malpractice now. had an operation on her ankle. She had a fracture. They put a screw in it. This is 1927, mind you, so it's a very old case. But they put a screw in into the... I apologize. I accidentally turned off the microphone while I was talking. But what I was saying was that they had put the screw in, and 7 years later, she had was having fits with the ankle and came back to the same doctor to take care of it. And the doctor looked at it. He made a couple of adjustments to her shoes and made a couple of adjustments to... and wrapped it and sent her on her way. And 2 years later, she comes back to the same doctor, and he kind of did the same thing, and she wasn't satisfied with that, so she went to another doctor who took an x-ray and determined and that there was the screw in there and should be operated to remove it. Our biggest takeaway from this is that a standard of care is going to be established by an expert testimony. The reason why bringing up this case is that the expert testimony did not actually say that, and let's just say he wasn't properly prepared, and he couldn't say whether or not there was a standard or if the defendant here had violated a standard. And as the plaintiff's expert testimony, that's the exact opposite of what you want him to say. So he wasn't very well prepared, and so Boyce, in this case, lost her case. Big takeaway, standard of care is going to be established by expert testimony. And the only exception to this is if the standard of care should have been so obvious and that it doesn't require an expert. At that time, even though an x-ray now might seem like a very obvious thing to have done, at that time, in the 1930s, x-rays were expensive. They were not easily done. And thus, it was not obvious that this should have been the standard of care. Morrison versus McNamara. And what happened here is that an individual was having an invasive, not operation, but examination done. And he was standing up. It caused him to faint. And he hit his head, banged his head, and had several injuries that resulted from that, including a permanent loss of taste and smell. The big takeaway here is that it was the local procedure at that time to do this test standing up. But nationally, it was the local nationally, the procedure was to have them either sitting down or laying down as this procedure was taking place. So we get this conflict of, should you use a national standard, a local standard, or a standard that is of a community that is similar to your local standard. Here they say that we should use a national standard, and the reason why is because that the physicians were nationally, well, the laboratory was nationally certified, and so they should have been expected to be held to a national standard. Previously, they were following this local standard, and there had been no exceptions to that. So, big takeaway here is that a national standard is always going to apply to medical labs and certified board of physicians. Hospitals are often going to be held to this national standard. However, in certain hospitals, whether there's insufficient facilities or insufficient equipment, they may be held to a localized standard just because they actually can't perform to the same capabilities of this national standard. And that was actually why there was a localized standard in the first place, was because a long time ago, it was to incentivize doctors to stay in rural areas because rural areas needed doctors, but they weren't as well trained as the urban doctors. And so by allowing this lesser localized standard, the doctors in rural areas were able to be found competent doctors in those areas. But with the accreditation of national procedures for doctors, this was no longer the case. Okay, moving on to this final case that we talked about today. There's Scott v. Bradford. This is going to be a bit different. So far, we've talked about a professional scenario. Yes, this is also a professional scenario, but it's going to differ in the sense of we're not going to use a professional standard, but we're going to use an informed consent doctrine. Here, there was a plaintiff, a patient, who had a surgery, and she was not told all the risks of the surgery, but she underwent the surgery. She signed the regular consent forms, and there were complications, which resulted in several more surgeries. And she claimed that had she known about the potential complications, she would not have had this surgery. Okay, so there's some big things to talk about here just with the rule of law. First thing to know is that there is a difference between battery and negligence when it comes to consent. So here, informed consent or lack of informed consent, but having other consent is negligence. If consent is not obtained, or if it exceeds the scope of the consent, then it's going to be a battery. Let me just restate that. If consent is obtained but is not properly informed, it is negligence. But if consent is not obtained, or if you exceed the scope of the consent, it is going to be a battery. So a patient suing under the lack of informed consent must prove, one, that there was adequate information about the material risks. Two, had they been performed, they would not have accepted treatment. And three, there must be a harm or injury that is felt from the treatment. So for this first element that we talked about, whether or not there's a material risk, we need to find out if there's adequate informed consent here. And to do that, there needs to be enough information about the treatment, the available alternatives, and the potential risk. There are some times, though, when informed consent is not necessary, and that is if everyone should know that this is something that you would consent to. It's so obvious that consent does not, well, that informed consent does not need to apply. Two, if it's an emergency. And three, if it's in the best interests of the patient's care. This last one, though, we need to be careful with, because if we're not careful with it, this exception could actually override the rule. So even if it's in the best interest of the patient's care, courts are going to be inclined not to accept that as an exception unless if you can really prove it. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro. And you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't our pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice, and with that, the fourth thing is if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.